Oh, Miss Melody D'Amour, mi amor. Would you, I am trying to be a real famous magician. Would you help me?
No.
Okay, all right, well, take a card. Take any card. Take the one that's popped up in the middle, for example. Just take a card.
No.
Take a card.
No. It's not in my contract, no.
You 7! How about that? Isn't that wonderful?
No.
Who are your favorite magicians? Who do you love of all time? If you had to choose five, you can pick five. And that's not with the understanding that these aren't the only five you love.
Okay.
But or should I ask most influential or favorite to watch?
Those are two separate questions. They are two separate questions. If I had to name the greatest magician I ever saw, probably it would be Ricciardi.
I knew you were going to say that, but I'm glad you did. Will you tell them at home who he is? Because he's fabulous.
He was a Peruvian magician, second generation, who worked all over the world. He worked on stage. He technically was an illusionist, which is to say he did larger scale magic. Having said that, it was an illusion style really that was based in the 1940s and 50s when illusions got a bit more portable than what they had been in the earlier part of the century, or than what they became in the Vegas spectacles that followed. Mm. So most of the illusions that he performed were still relatively small, but it didn't matter because it wasn't about the illusions or the props, it was about him. Mm-hmm. And he was just so dynamic and exciting to watch. It was just thrilling to watch.
What would be an example of something he would have done?
His most notorious feat was sawing a woman in half, which doesn't sound that different from what many have done before and since, except that in his version, he used a buzzsaw, which others have done, no box, and when that buzzsaw cut into that woman, blood and guts went flying 20 feet in the air.
Wow.
So, yeah, he did not let the audience off the hook.
Love it.
Gallagher.
When he sawed a woman in half, he sawed a woman in half. And it was incredible. But
how many assistants did he have?
Sorry?
How many assistants did he have?
A different one every night, obviously.
He has three and a half.
He actually, no. His curtain speech, he closed with the sawing. And the sawing, he would put on a doctor's
coat.
White coat.
Yeah.
And the woman was brought out wearing sort of a hospital gown. And he would throw ether onto a cloth and smash the cloth into her face. And there was this very ominous music going on, and these two burly male assistants, and they would put her on, she was out, and they'd put her on the thing, and he'd start the saw, and he'd run this thing, and this arc of blood and guts would cascade forward. And then he would stop the proceedings, and all you would hear at this point was a heartbeat on the soundtrack.
Oh, wow.
Whoa.
And then he would invite the audience to come up and take a closer look.
Ooh.
And people would. And depending on the venue, it could be the next 20 to 30 minutes of people coming up the side stairs to the stage and walking over and taking a look at this woman splayed out on this surgical table with guts falling out of her side.
People must have gotten sick.
I would have passed out or run out.
Yeah, they would have gotten sick.
And when they finally finished the whole thing, he never actually brought her back. He would stand her up, or the assistants would stand her up under his guidance, and the viscera would plop to the floor, and you would sort of think she was restored, but maybe, maybe not. And the, and the curtains would close. And it was really kind of uncertain. And he would come forward, take off the robe.
Take a bow.
So now he was back into his bolero. And
he dressed like a sparkly bullfighter.
Nice.
And he would do his curtain speech. And the curtain speech, which was delivered with this melodic Peruvian accent, and he would say, ladies and gentlemen, this is my favorite part of the show just now, because, of course, this is where you come onto my stage, and I get to hear and see what your reactions are up close. And I heard a couple of interesting comments tonight. He said this at the end of every show, of course. There was a woman who came up and she took a look and she said, oh, it's terrible. Oh, it's awful. And I respect that. It's why I put this at the end of the show. And if you recall, I told you before I began this routine that it would be shocking and not for everyone. And by putting it at the end this way, if it wasn't for your taste, you could leave and not miss anything else. So I respect that. But there was another comment tonight that I didn't appreciate. No, two young men came up and they were looking at Rena. Rena was his daughter's name, who was on the slab. And they were looking at Rena, and one turned to the other and he said, it's not real. It's a trick. Of course it's a trick. Ladies and gentlemen, I couldn't kill a real girl every night. Everything I have done for you this evening has been a trick. And I do not ask that you believe that it is real. I only ask, was the trick well done?
Ah.
Deep bow, standing ovation.
What is the time period on this man?
What?
What's the time period on this man?
He died in the late 80s, I think.
Wow.
Maybe even early 90s.
Is that televised?
There's YouTube.
There are YouTube clips galore. He was on the Ed Sullivan Show on numerous occasions, and there are
not
some
doing
clips.
That.
No,
but he had the razor blades.
No,
on
but
there,
doing other things. Most of his repertoire exists on video. Some of it dating back to the 50s. There's a really good lengthy clip, 20 plus minutes, of him at the Olympia Theater in Paris from 1970 that, at least the last time I checked, was on YouTube. And it's black and white, but it's phenomenal. So he would certainly be...
Your favorite.
I don't know if I could say he's my single favorite, but he's way up there. I would say if I'm filling it out to five.
You can fill it out as much as you want, but I don't want you to get that long
in
list.
In no
where you
specific
feel like you're
order,
people, you know?
I would have to add Del Rey.
Will you tell them who Del Rey was?
Del Rey was primarily a close-up magician, although he did have a stage act as well. Phenomenally original and innovative.
In what capacity? Like, why do you say that?
His magic was simply different from what anybody else did.
Okay.
He went his own way. He was a brilliant inventor, a quirky performer. He had a very individual style that wouldn't have worked probably for anybody else. Because he neither looked nor sounded like a magician in any way that you would expect, and yet it all fit together. And he did miraculous things. He actually had one moment in his show. He would normally do a very long show. He much of his work was, particularly in his later years, was done for industrial, you know, corporate gigs where he would be in a hospitality suite, and you had to get invited to come to the hospitality suite. And he was very successful with this because when word got out and people got a sample, the story is that at trade shows they would put a sign up that said Del Rey will perform here at 3:30, and word would spread through the convention floor. And at 3:30 he would come and he would perform for a few minutes. And it was so strong that now the salespeople for the company he was representing would say, if you want to see more, you can get an invitation to our hospitality suite this evening. Of course, if you want that, you have to listen to our pitch. Mm-hmm. And they would do all these sales mm-hmm. leads based on that, because that short sample was enough for people to be tremendously hungry to see more. So when he would perform in the suite, he would do usually like 45 minutes or an hour. And in his full-length close-up show, there was one moment in his script, but it always he always played it as if he didn't mean it to come out the way it did. He would turn to one of the people sitting around the table, and he would say, tell me the truth, which was how he talked.
Nice.
Tell me the truth. When was the last time you saw a miracle? And inevitably, that person or someone sitting close by would say, 30 seconds ago.
Ah!
And he would pretend to get embarrassed. And no, that's not what I meant. But of course, they would burst into applause. And he would make as if, oh, that's not where I was going. And no, that wasn't a cheap way of getting extra.
But of course it was.
But of course it was scripted. Yeah.
It's wonderful.
But he did do miracles. He really did. His most famous piece, probably, was The Bird. He had a little bird. There was a particular type of wind-up mechanical bird that you would see sometimes in people's homes. They were made in Germany, and they were popular in like the 19-teens and 20s, I think. And there were these little mechanical birds, and you wound them up, and they would chirp and look around. And they'd be on a little perch I mean, I've seen them in people's homes. Mm-hmm. They don't make them anymore. And he had a bird essentially like that, except without the cage. So it was sitting on a little perch. In later years, he got a bigger bird to make it more easy to see. But it lacked the charm of the original bird. Mm-hmm. I got to see him with the original bird because I first saw him in 1970, 72. Anyway, he'd bring out the bird, and the bird would do miracles. All the bird did was look around and chirp. But it would do so in dialogue with Dell. So he would ask the bird a question, it would cheep in response, and he would do card tricks, and the bird would find selected cards and things under really amazingly fair conditions. And he had such great, great lines. And at one point he would say to the... He would say to the bird, he would do this routine where the bird would find a selected card. The cards were all dealt on the table into groups. And the bird would identify one of the groups, and then they'd put the other groups away, and then those would be distributed. So from a table full, then people would point to the different cards. And when the person was pointing to the right card, the cards all being face down, the bird would chirp. And it would be turned over, and it was, let's say, the Seven of Hearts.
Wow.
It was like the card. And everybody would applaud, and he would say, remember what that woman said the other night? And the bird would chirp.
Yes.
He'd say, yeah. She said, I know how that's done. Well, you know what we do whenever someone says that? We listen, because they may have a better method. So she said... All the cards are the Seven of Hearts. Remember what I said? Bird chirps. Right. Said we used to do it that way, as he's turning over all the cards to show that they're all different and it's a completely normal deck. So there was this wonderful whimsy to his work, and yet this profound sense of what was magic to a depth of impossibility that was just a beautiful thing. Mm. So he would have to be on the list.
Uh-huh.
Tommy Wonder.
Oh, uh-huh.
Who was just a Dutch magician who died about 10 years ago.
And
he was only 51 or two, I guess. And a close friend. Just a genius. The depth of understanding combined with an extraordinary level of performance, skill, and everything that went into it. Just marvelous. Well, I could name some people who are still alive.
Sure. We can make this list as a partial list of Max Maven's people to watch. How's that? So it's open and you can add to it at any time.
Okay.
Okay.
I'll mention Eugene Berger.
Oh, I love me some Eugene Berger.
He's got such there's such a richness to his work.
He called me on stage once with him.
Yeah?
Mr. Lee, too.
How did that feel? No,
yeah, he called me on stage.
Oh, you know what? It made me very, very nervous. Remember how nervous I was?
But were you nervous once you were up with him?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
You continue being nervous.
But no, not through the whole
relax,
thing.
You didn't get comfortable?
Yeah, not through the whole thing. It was in the Peller. When he was in the Peller, the last time.
With Michael
when
Carbonara.
He was working with Michael Carbonara, yeah.
A show that, it bears mention, Max Maven directed. Because in addition to all the other hats that he wears, he's also a director, producer, and act booker. He can also run lighting cues and speaks fluent Japanese.
I'm getting bored with these credits. You know who I'll mention because you can see them. If you're living in New York or going to be in New York, Derek and Helder.
Oh, yeah.
Derek Delgadio and Helder Guramesh. A name that I know I've just mispronounced because everybody does.
Yeah, I don't know how to say it.
It's spelled
G-U. Essentially Guramesh, but that's only an approximation.
I thought it was like Guimarães.
I don't think anybody who isn't Portuguese can get through it. Yeah. And I have a feeling that even the Portuguese can't really say it properly.
we just call him Helder.
Anyway, but Derek and Helder are two magicians still in their 20s. Helder from Portugal, Derek originally from Colorado, but they both are based in LA. And they put together a show initially at the Magic Castle, and then it grew and blossomed, and Neil Patrick Harris took a shine to it. He directed the show, and it played at the Geffen.
It's called Nothing to Hide.
Called Nothing to Hide. It played at the Geffen for a very successful run last year. Which was extended multiple times, and it's about to open in New York, and very much worth, if you're going to be in the area at all, finding. I believe it opens in November. My guess is, if they aren't crushed by the real difficulty in New York is getting noticed, because there's so much going on. Now, LA has a similar problem. They were able to absolutely get noticed in LA. They did extremely well. I hope the same thing will happen in New York for them.
Is Neil directing that as well now?
Yeah.
Is he?
Yes.
Oh.
There's every reason to expect that the show's going to be great. I mean, it will be great. I know the show will be great because I've seen the show.
I've seen it.
What I mean is it'll be great in terms of the success of the show.
Mm-hmm.
Speaking of which, there's another show going on in New York that I have not seen, but I've seen the guy doing it. And like him and his work a lot, and that's a young Israeli magician who's 30-ish, I don't know his exact age, named Asi Wind, who is doing a small theater run in New York, starting around now. I don't believe the show we are now in mid-October, and I don't think it's started yet, but I think it's starting like within the coming week or so. And it's called Concert of the Mind.
Okay.
And it is, I've seen Ossie work, and he's discussed some of his ideas about this show with me, but I don't know what the final outcome is, except that I expect it to be both amazing and engaging and not at all run-of-the-mill. So that's worth finding. So
intriguing.
Good stuff happening in New York.
Mm-hmm.
Less of it in LA right now. There's the Castle, of course, and that changes from one week to the next, and can be great. But there's not a lot happening outside of that in LA. I have a feeling I'm forgetting something, but anyway.
Well, that's all right.
Well, how about Vegas?
Vegas is not so strong for magic right now. It was, and you know, styles come and go. During the kind of classic period of review shows, when the archetypal Vegas show was a synthesis of the French Revue and the MGM musical, And that was a model that lasted in Vegas from the 1950s through to the 90s. Hmm. And magic fit into that tremendously, so that most of these production shows had, as one of their variety acts, one of the specialty acts, would have a magician. And it reached the point where there were some shows that were fully built around magicians, but built on this model. And that included, of course, Siegfried and Roy, mm-hmm. And Lance Burton and several others. However, what has happened in Vegas since the 90s is Cirque du Soleil has come to town and changed the model. And so essentially nobody's doing the classic production show anymore. That's really faded.
Do you think that could ever return?
Yeah. I think if and when it returns, it'll return in a mutated form. But it was evolving. I mean, when I say it lasted from the 50s through the 90s, that doesn't mean it wasn't frozen in amber.
No.
It grew and changed, and there were shows. When Siegfried and Roy, who were always kind of the trendsetters in this,
sure.
when they opened at the Mirage in, what, the early 90s, I guess?
Mm-hmm.
That show had evolved and was stylistically quite different from the shows in the 50s, 60s, 70s. You know, I mean, the model was not a static thing.
Mm-hmm.
But then Cirque du Soleil came along, and their model doesn't allow for the kind of variety act guests.
Right, because it's the entire troupe. I could see a very charismatic headliner coming back.
There is one of their shows, one of Cirque du Soleil's shows, and I'm not sure what the name of the show is or where it is. It's not in Vegas. But one of their shows the does have a headliner in the form of a juggler. And, oh, I'm embarrassing myself. I can see his face and I can't think of his name. He is...
The only one I can think of is Roy Jones.
No,
it's not Charlie Fry.
No. This is I was about to say a kid. He's not a kid anymore. But this is a young man who was working Vegas starting at the age of 8.
Wow.
And in major production shows. And he's got an Italian name, and I can't think of his name.
That's
I can
okay.
see his face.
We'll look Brecci. It up.
What is it?
Brecci?
No. He is widely acknowledged as the world's greatest juggler as far as technical skill goes.
Hmm.
He holds a number of records for the most objects
mm-hmm.
kept going. And when he started, they emphasized how young he was because he was only 8 or 9 years old. And so they had him come out on stage in shorts. And he had no personality, but he was like amazing. He was like a talking dog. This kid can
just let him go.
Do all these amazing mm-hmm. things. He's now developed an on-stage personality, and he's got a
Anthony Gatto.
Anthony Gatto. Jesus, I can't believe I just couldn't. I said Italian. I said it was an Italian surname.
You did. You were right.
But anyway,
you know
yes,
where I found it?
Anthony
my
Gatto.
Cell phone, Max. My cell phone.
Yeah, I get it. So Anthony is extraordinary and always has been. I mean,
uh-huh.
even at the age of 8, he was doing stuff that most
sure.
most lifetime skilled jugglers couldn't do and mm-hmm. still can't do. And after having been in countless different review shows over the years, recently, and I think currently, he's in a Cirque du Soleil show where he's the feature. And that's unusual
wow.
for a Cirque show. But I don't know which show he's in. It's not in Vegas. He's
okay.
It's somewhere else. But
well,
it's,
Cirque picked up Criss Angel, too. You know, they
yeah,
were doing,
but,
they,
but...
So they were trying to expand into
yeah,
variety a
but,
little
but
bit,
when
is
they,
saying.
But when they picked up Criss Angel... and tried this show that was sort of a synthesis between what Chris was doing and what Cirque wanted to do, it didn't gel. And
mm-hmm.
so although they're still technically producing the show, it's still billed as a Cirque show. But almost all the Cirque elements have been taken out.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Hmm.
Interesting.
You know, I could see somebody like your ex-president, Neil Patrick Harris, doing a Vegas review show where he would be the MC star slash... You know, come out, sing, dance, introduce the acts, and then, you know, wrap things up.
Well, he's certainly more than capable of doing that. I don't
yeah.
think that's what Neil is interested
no,
in
No, I don't
doing.
Think that's his career
but
game.
Boy, would
he's
going
to do
New
a
York.
Broadway show now,
mm-hmm.
isn't he? Yeah.
Well, and he's got Derek and Helder and stuff. Yeah. So
he was originally on Kuza, Cirque du Soleil's Kuza, but now he's doing La Nuba.
Another Cirque show?
Yep.
And where?
It doesn't say where.
Okay.
This is Anthony Gatto, yes, not Patrick Harris, yes, okay.
Yeah, Neil Patrick Harris is juggling for some reason.
It's very, very good.
All Cirque du Soleil show sounds like the names of Ethiopian restaurants that I don't care to eat at.
Mm-hmm.
Florida, downtown Disney.
Uh-huh.
Okay. So since we're talking about Cirque du Soleil shows sounding like restaurants that you don't, at which you don't wish to eat.
I say that I've had some very fine Ethiopian food, but
we don't have a lot of Ethiopian listeners. I think you're good.
Okay.
What is the
way to cover that?
Thank you.
I'm sorry, Makambe.
Worst kind of magic on the planet. What can you not stand to see? I don't want names, of course. I mean, you can give me some if you want to dish dirt, but I don't think you do, because that's not who you are. But what's like the worst kind of magic for you? What's actually painful for you to watch?
There's no type of magic I don't think, unless I'm repressing it somehow. I don't think there's any style or type of magic that I find difficult to watch if it's done well and if it's approached well.
Okay.
What I find difficult to watch is magic done badly, especially if the intent is crass.
Okay.
And I have sometimes said that watching bad magic is similar to watching children being tortured, except with less entertainment value.
Wow. I'd say the same thing about bad cartoons.
Agreed.
So I won't name any names.
No,
but
I don't want them because that's no fun.
There are certain performers who just aren't good and who kind of mangle the material they're trying to perform by virtue of inability and lack of skill or prowess or rehearsal. That's hard enough to watch. But when someone offers that and one gets the impression that they could improve, but they're too lazy or they're too self-absorbed or they've set other goals,
mm-hmm.
That's hard to watch. That's very hard to watch.
So for you, what I'm hearing is the magic that's hardest for you to watch is magic which is disrespectful to magic.
Yeah.
Kind of.
Yeah.
You know, like either they didn't put in the time or the brain power to really make an effort.
Yeah.
Especially ego, you know, like when you've got arrogance involved and it's like, no, they could be better. They're choosing not to for whatever reason. And it's because they think they're fine.
Yeah.
Or they're not, you know, or they don't know that they're not, you know.
Yeah. So. I mean, I don't think, and maybe I'm naive, but I don't think anybody sets out to be bad or sets out to deliver or create a bad product.
Except
you know,
Magic Princess
Carl
and
Valentine.
We can take this completely, but Carl was brilliant.
Yes,
he did it on purpose. Carl was brilliant. I remember back in the 80s, there was a convention south of here. It was either San Diego or Long Beach. There was a big magic convention, and because of the location, a lot of Japanese came over to attend. And they had no idea who Carl Ballantyne was because Carl wasn't known outside of the United States. And he came out and he did his set. And of course, in his act, none of the magic worked. Never finished a trick in the act. And in this particular performance, at one point, the mic popped out of the stand and fell on the stage at one moment, which clearly was a genuine error, not a gag, and he got two standing ovations. And after the show, various Japanese friends said to me, "We are completely perplexed. Why was he so well received? He didn't do any magic, and he even dropped the mic." And I said, "Well, I said, this is really hard to explain." It was all the more so because I was trying to explain it in Japanese. But I said, there's basically three reasons. And one is that he's, you know, beloved. I mean, he's been around a long time. He's, as you saw, he's an elderly man. And people know him from from many television performances, and so there's a lot of affection just based on that. I said, secondly, the jokes are really funny, and I realize that they're not all funny if you don't understand what he's saying, but if you understand the attitude and the context, it's genuinely funny. Mm-hmm. But the third thing, and this is almost impossible to explain, you just have to take my word for it, because even non-American English speakers have trouble with this. But for Americans, Carl's timing is perfect. It isn't simply really good. It isn't even simply excellent. It's perfect. It cannot be better. And that's impossible to explain. And as I say, it doesn't even ring true to British ears, for example. Most British magicians or audiences never particularly got Carl. Mm-hmm.
But I think that goes for the timing of his non-magic tricks as well, and him being a true magician and being able to carry that through.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. No, there was a real gestalt to Carl. I mean, it was not one thing, it was everything. Mm-hmm. And he was great. He was
and a
really
hell of a nice
quite
guy.
Amazing. Yeah.
I sat backstage with him. He presented the Comedy Magician of the Year Award, and I was there as his specs. Mark Nelson, a dear friend of all of ours, actually everybody loved Mark, miss him, had asked me to come because he had written a joke for Carl where Carl said, I can't read this without my specs. And he said, specs? And Mark said, corset, and come in. And he says, there we go, 36, 24, 36. Those are the specs. Specs, read this for them. Then he handed it to me and I was going to read it. So we're sitting backstage. It was
very
cute.
Careful with that joke, it's an antique.
Yeah, I know. So most of the stuff for the award show was. Mm. But we were sitting backstage, and it was the year Criss Angel was receiving the Magician of the Year Award. Do you know the story? Have I told it to
you? Yes, you have.
Oh, well, then I won't bother you.
No, go ahead.
Do you know it? I don't know.
I'm sure your listeners don't know.
I'll tell it as quickly as possible. So we're sitting there, and Criss Angel, we're having a very nice conversation about the racetracks and about his kids, and we're really connecting. Super nice dude. And I'm, like, thrilled to be there. I'm just like, oh, my God, you see that? You know, so, and he's, well, first of all, he wouldn't read the copy. Like, he wouldn't read the script. I kept handing, do you want your script? No. And he's like listening. And then he just crumples up the script. He tears up the part that he's supposed to say about me because I'm there. And then he goes, get me a spoon. And so he goes out and he's going to do a spoon routine. And he killed with it. He just cut all the jokes that had been written for him, did something he knew was going to work based on what the audience had laughed at before. Mm-hmm. But, well, so that's a testament to how brilliant this man was and how deep and rich his repertoire was. He said, this is what they're laughing at. I'm going to do the spoon. Okay, so he felt his audience out just based on where their laughter fell. So I learned that day. But also we were sitting in the back and Criss Angel came in and we're talking. And he goes, oh, excuse me. And he literally is like separating our energy with his hands. Like he's swimming into the room. And Carl's just sitting there watching him and he says nothing.
Saying, who the hell is this?
He didn't know. He said nothing. Carl just waited. And he said nothing. He excused him, you know. Excuse me. Criss walks right between us to the mirror. And he goes, I just want to see how stupid I look. Okay, pretty stupid. And he just turns around nervously, leaves the room. And Carl's just sitting there, flatly. And he waits a moment and he goes, he has no idea how stupid he looks.
Always the right thing at the right time.
And it was only for me. And now it's all for you guys. But it was only for me.
And bathroom break.
I just fell completely. I fell completely in love with the man.
I know.
It was like, yes, you are, because he was, not only was he funny, but also he was right, you know?
I want Sarah to take over on his act. I think she could do a pretty good job with it.
Valentine Jr.
Yeah.
Carl Ballantyne has daughters, and all of his daughters are named after racetracks, and so Sarah is short for Saratoga. And
which is the town in which I am from.
Hey, now.
What's Molly short for?
A racetrack in Mexico, Tijuana, a racetrack in Tijuana, I believe.
Oh, okay. So doesn't have a child named Pimlico or something like that.
Santa Anita.
Bay Meadows.
He loved Santa Anita.
I know he did. He spent a lot of his
life. He made Sarah go there all the time.
Well, just to recap for a second, your least favorite types of magic are the ones by magicians who are too full of themselves and yet don't know anything, which I call the
professor. He actually didn't say that. Those are words I put in his mouth.
I call it the Professor Hinkle syndrome.
I would agree with you if I knew who Professor Hinkle was.
There's a Christmas special called Frosty the Snowman, and Professor Hinkle, voiced by the wonderful Billy DeWolf, was a bad magician. And he gets angry at his rabbit and throws out his top hat, which he claims is malfunctioning, lands on Frosty the Snowman's head, and Wonder of Wonders, it has magic in it, brings him to life.
Happy birthday!
I never knew the origin story.
You didn't know the origin story of Frosty?
I don't think I ever watched the Frosty the Snowman special.
Oh, that's rather unfortunate.
Well, it's been toned down a bit since the Druidic rite of children sacrificed to the snow god that actually brought Ymir the Frost Giant to life with a corncob pipe and a button nose, but it got whittled down a little bit for television. I'm rambling.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Okay. So.
Side note, Jones.
Yeah, so you wanted to recap and go back to what Max said was bad magic.
Yeah. And I don't like that, too. It's like, yeah,
I don't like that, too.
Nobody likes that. You know, it's the guy.
It's the majority of the art.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess no. I think that there's kernels of wonderful in a lot of different acts that a lot of people think are dreadful. I think that there's always a moment, well, not always, but oftentimes there's a moment of, you know what, I'm glad I watched that because I either learned something or I felt something there, even if it was dismay. You know, like sometimes it's nice to see acts that other people do.
In all forms of endeavor, magic, and in all the attendant performance things that speak like that.
So we have a couple more. I have a couple more questions for you, and then we have a couple of questions from people.
Okay.
But I'm going to ask the people questions first because my questions, just so that you know what they are, the ones.
Oh, don't tell me! Don't tell me!
Oh, okay. Well, you should know what they are.
So much more fun to. So much more fun to take them.
The tweets I got were, "What was your first magic trick?" And you told that one,
right?
And somebody asked when I'd be back on Batman. So.
Sorry. This is asinine.
When Kevin asked me.
The other question was, is this your card?
Also, oh, thank you so much.
Yeah. Do you do birthday parties?
The answer is no. Yeah. Go ahead.
Yes. Do you do birthday parties?
Have you seen a decrease, increase, or no change in the public's interest in magic lately?
Oh,
that's a really interesting question. To put this in perspective, magic, as with so many other things, comes in waves. So there are times when magic increases or decreases as far as its visibility in the popular cultural map. Since the mid-90s, magic got a big boost in the 70s through Doug Henning and then through David Copperfield. And then it went flat. It went fallow. It didn't not exist at all, but it wasn't very central to the awareness of people who weren't explicitly interested in it. And this flipped in the mid-1990s for a variety of reasons, some of them being kind of circumstantial rather than any kind of zeitgeist. Magic got moved to a much more central position on that map. And even though it has not sustained the degree of centrality, the degree of cultural awareness that it gained in the mid to late 90s, it hasn't gone away the way that it did during parts of the 80s, during parts of the 60s. It has managed to sustain better than it had before. I don't fully know why, but it has. And so even though I would not say that this is a time when magic's strength is at its best, it's okay. It's okay enough that there's some interesting work being done and there are places for people to do it.
Did you have any other questions on there? Because I have a couple here for him. Okay. Scott Klinger asks you, what changes or direction would you specifically like to see in mentalism in the future?
The same as I'd like to see from any art form. First of all, an acknowledgement that it is an art form. Let's start there.
Mm-hmm.
That it can be something more than the intellectual equivalent of eye candy. I think that at its best, magic, as with any other medium for the performance of art, is expressing ideas, expressing a worldview on the part of the performer that brings things to the audience that they otherwise wouldn't have experienced. And the magic is the medium, the magic is the vehicle for these ideas. It's not the end in and of itself. It's rather what is used to get to the good stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I would like to see more of that.
Mm-hmm.
Don't forget the beauty of it.
Well, the aesthetic of it kind of comes along for the ride automatically. You know, I mean, when music has something interesting to say.
But when people think of art, they think of how it's attractive to them, I guess.
Well, I don't think all art is attractive. Do you?
No, I do not.
I mean, if you look at a Franz Klein painting, it's not necessarily meant to make you feel serene.
So,
I mean, there are paintings which certainly do achieve that, but I don't think that's automatic.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the aesthetics, whatever those may be, and I'm more often than not, they are beauty-oriented, but I think those kind of come along for the ride almost by definition. It's like with music, you know, the fact that music is appealing, whether it's rhythmically appealing or harmonically appealing, or in terms of the tones achieved by a singer's voice or particular combinations of instruments, they aren't the end point of great music.
Mm-hmm.
They come along, they're present because the music is going somewhere beyond that.
Mm-hmm.
I think.
Mm-hmm. I agree. So Todd Carr has a Max-like reply, which he's put in quotes and I don't get.
Okay.
Validating tradition, Max's attire apparently went black once. True? I don't get it.
We covered that.
I don't think that's what he meant. This might be a dirty joke. Cut that. Knowing
I'm just not sure I understand it.
It'd be a dirty joke.
Validating tradition, I suppose, had something to do with the tradition of mysterious people wearing black. I suppose, but I don't know if he's
implying that you slept with the black chick, and I can't.
Just skip right.
I didn't get that from it.
It's probably
not good.
So, we have one other question from a listener, and his name is Daniel Campisi, and I know he's a big fan because I know Daniel. You know Daniel too. He's a big fan of magic, but a huge fan of Max Maven. And Daniel asks, which is actually going to lead into our final question for tonight, is I'd love to have you back if you're ever interested in coming back, because I have so many questions that I didn't touch on, and we have like 3.5 hours worth of material, and I'm so thrilled, and you've been so generous with your time. So there's like so many things. I mean, this man was a seance medium at the Magic Castle long before I was, and did a totally different show than what's typical. Like, I have so many questions to ask you, but anyway. So Daniel asks you, what do you think are the biggest challenges facing new and upcoming magicians today versus the challenges faced 10, 20, or 30 years ago? You kind of touched on a little bit of how the climate has changed, but challenge-wise?
I think one of the issues facing magicians today that is different from when I was coming up, there weren't any hip magicians as far as the public's perception. There were some very hip magicians, but the public wasn't particularly aware of them. And so most magicians were kind of stuck relating to a classical model that was way out of date and could be lovely in and of itself, but was kind of square in the same way that classical music was relegated to being square. In more recent times, particularly post David Blaine, there are now strong models of hip magicians. Mm-hmm. But that, because so much has sped up in our culture, thanks to the internet and various other forms of instant communication, these models of what is now become iconic in the way of a hip magician, they're starting to show signs of age already. Mm-hmm. Now, that is not meant as any sort of a knock against David Blaine or the Bucks or any of the young magicians who are succeeding, but rather that they are, or should be, and I think they are, in the process of modifying the model, changing what they're doing, changing who they are, as opposed to simply recycling what was hip 10, 15 years ago. Mm-hmm. What I'm seeing on the part of a lot of young magicians is they're recycling versions of hip that aren't anymore. So there's kind of a danger in the fact that there was success in magic being reinterpreted in hip ways. And the danger is that people get locked into whatever that version of hip is. And by its very definition, hipness is something that has to constantly reinvent itself, mm-hmm. or it becomes unhip by a kind of automatic process.
You know, I can see that where, I mean, I think the image that a lot of people have of the classic magician is a fellow in top hat and tails, mm-hmm. and that is that's at the same time an outdated image, but it's a very eternal image of the mandrake type mm-hmm. magician. Whereas somebody who came along in the last 5 years and had a look that was very pegged to that time seems more old fashioned in a way, because people are looking 5 years ahead.
Like new things become old much faster than old things.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
When Lance Burton first surfaced in the late 70s, circa 1980, he went to FISM, which is the triennial Olympics of Magic, to mm-hmm. use shorthand, and he won. And
that was kind of
a big breakthrough. First American, the youngest to ever win it. Mm. And Lance did a classical style act. And that same year, there was another magician of similar age, and I won't say who it was, except to say that he won a prize, but he didn't win the Grand Prix, as Lance did. And there were people in Europe at the time who said, oh, but he should have won because he had a very futuristic act, whereas Lance, we've seen that, it's old. Well, they were wrong, and in my opinion, and they were wrong because Lance was doing something that was neoclassical. On the surface, what he was doing was very classical. The style, with some very tiny aesthetic embellishments, the style was taken right out of a 19th century thing. But if you looked at some of the moments of self-reference and some of the timing moments, it was a very modern act. It just was in the trappings of something classical. And whereas the other act, as was commented at the time by Jim Steinmeier, a very wise inventor of magic,
and
commenter on magic. Mm-hmm. And Jim's comment about this second act was, when everybody was saying how futuristic it was, he said, yeah, it's futuristic in the sense of it's a throwback to science fiction tropes from the 1930s. It's actually
neo-futurist.
more outdated than a classical act. And in fact, if you were to look at tapes of those two acts now, mm-hmm. the guy who did the other act has moved on and he's working in very different styles. And if you were still doing that style, it would be incredibly embarrassing, mm-hmm. Because it was so much on the surface. and even on the surface, it didn't hold up to scrutiny. Lance, in his classical manner, had picked something that had stability, mm-hmm. and had actually gone further forward with it than seemed obvious to a lot of observers, mm-hmm. if that makes any sense.
Absolutely.
So I think one of the problems that young magicians have right now is they're getting attached to stylistic images and ideas that are already on their way out, but they don't know that.
Mm-hmm. I see the same thing in comics, you know, like where young up-and-comers in comic books, for instance, guys who were 17, 18, mm-hmm. who are just starting their career, will look back to guys in the 90s who had a very dynamic style and say, and for the reason of, those guys made millions of dollars when they started Image Comics, so I'm going to imitate what they did. Yeah. And the Image Comics style was based very little on the comics of 20 years before it, and based nothing on the artists who were drawing in the 60s and 50s, things like people like Jack Kirby and Neil Adams. Well, he was more in the 60s, but Stranko, he's kind of his own thing, but I'm thinking like the guys who started Frazetta,
Eisner,
you know, people like that. Yeah. They wanted to be fine artists, and they looked at and guys like Bernie Hogarth. They all looked at Grey's Anatomy, and they looked at the way to draw, to really construct a figure, mm-hmm. and they looked at fine art and classical art, and they said, "How can I do this to meet the demands? How can I take what I have to meet the demands of work, rather than how can I take the work that is current and make it make me look better?" Mm-hmm. So it's like Kirby was saying, how can I take the dynamics of the work I've studied and turn that into something that is eye-catching, that is popular, that's going to sell a lot of books, that's going to keep me in print for a while? It's based on building blocks, whereas comic artists now are just looking back at the work of whose work has sold a lot. And imitating that, and then all that, unless you're very lucky, that crashes and burns. It's the same in animation. Somebody who's got classical animation training who figures out how animators back in the 40s worked out animation techniques, you know, it's a firm base rather than somebody who looks back at only as far as Pixar. Family Guy and said.
Or Pixar.
Yeah, well, yeah. But
you know, because it's different.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But to get a show on Fox or something. Mm-hmm. It has to be a family show. It has to be a fat, buffoonish dad, a couple of, you know, wisecracking kids, and there it is. You know, it's like, well, there's no. You look back at Seth MacFarlane and you imitate Seth MacFarlane, you're going to be a very pale. You're not going to say anything. Mm-hmm. So if you're looking back only as far as Chris Angel because he's got a dramatic look and is doing kind of shocking magic, that's already gone. Mm-hmm. It's already passed.
Well, it's not if you ask Chris Angel.
Well,
yeah,
it is as far as, like, you know, the innovators.
Let him get his own podcast.
Yeah. I think he's probably got one. So were you going to present any other problems? Because I have something that I see as a problem for contemporary magicians, too, that I was going to toss into the ring for discussion.
Well,
but I don't want to cut you off.
It's somewhat connected to what I was just talking about, which is that the way in which magicians are learning the basics of their craft is changing, and not necessarily in a good way. And that's all due to the internet. Mm-hmm. The internet has many wonderful things going for it. But in the case of magic, there are all these kids coming into magic who are learning magic through downloading MPEGs and instant gratification.
Mm-hmm. And tutorials.
And there's no, so they're losing the sense of studying and growing and learning. It's all gimme right now. And that doesn't lead to, in most cases, it doesn't lead to very good results. At this moment, I would say, and this is all due to the internet, the quality of magic invention is down from where it has been in the past, and the quality of magic performance is down. Now, that's not to say that there aren't major exceptions to those statements, in both invention and performing, but the overall quality is down. The one place that the quality is up right now is in historical research and the theory and analysis that attaches to that. Magic is going through a boom period in that because the internet has enabled research in ways that were literally impossible up until a few years ago. So the internet has been tremendously helpful to the analysis of magic history in particular, but then by extension, magic theory. This is a good period for that. It is not as good a period for performing and inventing, thanks to the same medium. But hopefully that will change. It always does. It'll change not because of changes of technology, it'll change because one kid will come along. Right at this moment, there's some kid who isn't listening to this podcast because he or she is somewhere lying in bed, unable to sleep because there's something they really want to say, and the medium through which they wish to express this, which they don't fully know what it is or how to articulate it, but the medium that speaks to them is the medium of mystery. And they will, if the stars align properly, they will latch onto magic and find a way to use magic to make those expressions. And that's what moves magic forward. All the rest is just trimming.
Yeah.
That's a wonderful place at which to stop. You know, there's and actually some of the questions that I was going to ask you are a kernel of advice from you to end on for a beginner in magic, someone who's an intermediate or amateur performer, and a pro. Do you have something for one of each of those people, or is it one thing for all of them?
Whenever I'm asked for advice to magicians, there's one piece of advice that I give that covers every magician, myself included. It doesn't matter where you are in your development, because the advice is always valid. And the advice is slow down. And by that, I don't mean perform slower, although that's not infrequently a useful suggestion. It's not what I'm talking about. What I mean is, you don't accomplish things quickly in this field. In fact, you don't accomplish things quickly in most fields. But we live under the illusion that we do. Mm-hmm. All the more so with changes of technology and information. And the example I always use with this is, I don't know that anybody in this room has ever sired a baby, but babies begin to walk right around the 1 year mark. Maybe a few weeks earlier, some cases a few weeks later, but it's really some 11, 12 months, 13. It's right in there that they begin to walk. And that's how long it takes. And if you have a baby and the baby is 7 months old, the baby is not going to walk. Now, you can threaten the baby. You can plead with the baby. You can bribe the baby.
Oh, that's got to work.
None of it works. The baby's not going to walk because there is a certain amount of time that it takes for that baby to develop to the point that it can walk. And most babies, when they hit approximately 1 year, they will get there and they will walk. But you're not gonna trim time off of that because it takes a certain amount of time for the baby to reach that point in its development. And in the same way, there are certain techniques of magic, and by that I'm not only referring to the sleight of hand that we immediately think of, but other techniques of performing that you don't learn in 6-7 months. You may not learn it in 12 months. Some techniques may take a decade. Whatever the amount of time involved, it's probably more than you would prefer, but that's how it works. sorry, but that's how it works. So my overall advice is slow down. And if you keep at it, eventually you get to the next step.
That's a fantastic place to stop, I think. Max, I can't begin to thank you. I mean, you've been so generous with your time. And when you were out of the room, I was like, oh my God, we got to have him back on because there's so many questions that I still want to ask. And we just put like a late notice and we still got like, I think I put it on just as we were starting and we still got like 8 questions from people that signed in. So you're obviously a hot commodity and there a lot of people have questions for you. And you've just been so generous. And Trish, we're thrilled to have you on.
It's been fun.
We'd really, really love to have you back, and thank you very much for everything that you've given. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It was just wonderful.
I feel wiser.
Right? Mm-hmm.
My work is done here.
Where did he go? He just made a gesture.
I don't know. A bus went by and he was gone.
There it goes. I'm telling you. He's a magician.
This has been another episode of Radio Rashi. If you've enjoyed this episode, let everyone know by leaving a review in the iTunes Store. It's a great way to help others find us. You can also leave comments on RadioRashi.com, Facebook.com/RadioRashi, or follow us on Twitter at Radio Rashi or at Paul_Dini to leave us questions. Thanks for listening, and tell your friends.